everybody. My name's Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And welcome to Tactical Tennis Podcast. And we're through to the men's quarterfinals for the US Open after today's or tonight's results.
Indeed we are. And I'm recording from down the road over here. Well, a little more than down the road at the moment.
Down the road from where? You might have to be a little explicit.
From the US Open.
Okay.
I'm staying in Midtown in the city, so Flushing's a good 20 minutes away.
Right.
But anyway, let's dive in. We had some exciting stuff go down over the last few hours.
The last few days, really. I mean, it's been a pretty crazy few days, frankly. I guess if we jump back to the fourth round and the bottom half of the draw, since those matches happened first, and obviously some exciting stuff happened tonight that we'll get to pretty shortly here, but if we start at just the very, very bottom and work our way up real quick, because, you know, the quarterfinals are all set now. We've got all eight guys in place. Schwartzman's through to the quarterfinals, taking down Puyer in four sets. Which, you know, to me was a little bit of a surprise result, but...
Wait, Schwartzman being in the quarterfinals?
No, Schwartzman beating Puyer. Like, nothing about this draw is surprising anymore. But we can still look at the individual matches and say that things are surprising, not surprising. And to me, I thought Puyer would pull through this one just by virtue of you know, being a little bigger, having just a little more to bring to the table. But Schwartzman, too steady.
Too steady, and I don't know, too much for everybody so far. Schwartzman is probably returning serve better than anybody on the tour right now. No way I would have predicted him to be in the quarterfinals.
No, I don't think anybody would have. I mean, if there's somebody out there, let me just say, if there's somebody out there who's done, you know, one of the little draw challenges and they had this predicted, then I don't even know. I don't even know what to say. I'm out of words.
That's actually hilarious. I didn't do a draw challenge for this one. Like, I filled it out and actually didn't submit it in time. Mm-hmm. But they must just be absolutely shattered. Like, I can't see anyone predicting, frankly, the top half or the bottom half. I mean, we've got Rublev in the quarterfinals. I don't know. We've never even talked about Rublev on the show.
No. And
so
I can't imagine
that anybody had him in the quarter against Rafa.
No, I mean, look, this is madness. But let's dive in a little bit. You know, I don't think the Puyer-Schwartzman match is in and of itself as interesting as some of the other ones. I'd rather spend a little bit of time talking about Karina Buster's win over Shapovalov, who, by the way, you know, I said a while back that I was just going to keep calling him Shapovalov no matter what, but respect. I actually went and learned how to say his name properly off the ATP website from the way that he pronounces it, and I'm going to try my best to use the correct pronunciation from now on. I've been at it for a couple of days. So he says Shapovalov. And the emphasis on the va in the middle of it all. So, you know, I think at one point, very recently, before the round of 16, actually, the bookies had Shapovalov as the third favorite to take home the title, which I just want to pause. And look, I know that that's influenced some by the betting, but that's absurd. I think anybody who realistically thought he was actually going to take down the title, that's a little crazy. And this is why. Like, this match to me is exactly why. You know, I spoke in the earlier rounds as he was coming through and did well. Heck, we spoke about this after Montreal, that Shapovalov has great upside. I mean, I love the way that he plays the game. He is one of my favorite people to watch right now. But there's a question with his youth of how good a job he's going to learn to do of managing his risk. And making the right decision in the right moment. It's great to be young and fearless and to swing freely, which he certainly does that. But then you also have to know how to temper that and use some patterns and play in a way that maximizes your strengths and minimizes your weaknesses. And when he came up against Karina Buster, you know, obviously not a flashy player, but there's a reason that Shapovalov lost this match in straight sets. And there's a reason why the three tiebreakers weren't particularly close.
Right.
You know, if we look at the match here, sure, Shapovalov absolutely drove play. I mean, he had 54 winners and 55 unforced errors. And Karina Busta had 25 winners, 29 unforced errors. Yeah, Shapovalov's got the weapons in this matchup, and he came out and he certainly used them. But the problem is he didn't use them to good effect. And a very telling statistic to me is this one. Distance covered. Okay? There's not a big disparity here. But Shapovalov covered 9,053 feet to Karina Busta's 8,761. So there's basically a 300-foot gap between the two. But to me, if you are the guy that comes out and you have the bigger weapons, mm-hmm. why are you running more?
Well, hopefully that's not a rhetorical question.
No, I mean, this is something I think that it's worth us talking a little bit about. You know.
So this is interesting because it seems like we can see where you're going with this, and it's not a bad point. I am of the persuasion, though, that if you have the bigger weapons, you should run more in order to use them and in order to get in position to use them. And so I think this stat is, to some degree, I don't want to say misleading, perhaps incomplete is a better way to think about it. That even if you have the weapon, it means perhaps you don't have to pull the trigger as soon. It means that maybe you can, say, like circle around a ball instead of taking the shortest line to it so that you can get behind it more and really kind of unleash more power on it.
Yeah, but that, I mean, you're talking about footwork here, and I'm talking about tactics and strategy and shot selection.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you asked about the stat, right?
Yeah.
And this is where I say I think it can be a little bit misleading because, you know, in Shapovalov's case, it's going to be hard for me to adjust because I've been saying it wrong apparently for the last 2 years.
Yeah, both.
And yes, 2 years because that goes all the way back to junior tennis for him. Sorry, tennis, my bad. I don't think that's the case for Dennis that he's running more because he's doing like a great job. Like a guy that I look to for that is Andy Murray. He runs, and we don't have this stat broken down. I've just looked at it with some of those Hawkeye folks, but like he runs more on the backhand side than a lot of his opponents, but he's doing that in a way where he's doing it for position. He's doing it in order to get to where he wants to. And he's not losing matches on the backhand side of the court for sure.
Right, but I think there's other factors in play that are causing that. But, you know, like if we look at Fed's, you know, match against Cole Schreiber and against Yuzny, you know, both primarily or more baseline guys that, you know, where he had Fed's the guy with the bigger weapons and he runs less than both those guys. Like, you know, if you go through and look, generally speaking, the guy that has the bigger weapons is going to do less moving. And again, there's a very good reason for that. And I think that it's very telling for Shapovalov specifically, that he's out there playing against a guy who he bosses around the court or can boss around the court, but he's running more. And this tells me that he's not following good patterns, that he's not playing himself into position and then pulling the trigger on the right balls.
Right.
You know, he's playing himself out of position, you know, going down the line on shots maybe he shouldn't be going down the line on.
Whether or not we can tell that from the stat itself, I completely agree with what you're saying. So just the last thing I'll say on the stats, like here's a contrary example. I pulled up the numbers for the Nadal-Dolgopolov match, right? Nadal actually runs 600 feet more. He covers 600 feet more than Dolgopolov. He beats him 6-2, 6-4, 6-1.
Yeah, no, but Nadal is that's a very different match.
Right.
It's a very different matchup.
And it's because Nadal is working his way in order to impose those weapons. And that's something that I don't think Dennis is doing. He's more just swinging free and running around a little bit aimless, frankly.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, he's not playing himself into position. He's not hitting a ball that minimizes his movement and maximizes his advantages. I mean, he's not getting the matchup that he wants to and then just beating down on it till he can finish the point. you know, there's some structure that's missing, and that's just youth, and it'll get better. But, you know, I think that that's, it's just a very telling thing to me about how he's going around and playing. And again, like, there's a reason why he lost this match. There's a reason why he's out now, and there's a reason why he wasn't realistically going to win this tournament. And that is because he doesn't yet have that figured out. He doesn't yet have the risk management. He doesn't yet have the patterns. That takes time. He's 18 years old. It's going to come. You know, he's going to keep working. He's going to keep getting better. But he's not there yet. And so not surprising that he's out now. And, you know, not surprising that he lost to a guy who goes out and just works hard and puts a lot of balls in play.
Yeah. And he hits him hard, for the record.
Yeah,
he
no, I mean, for sure.
When he still play. He
yeah,
hits
no, he does. But he's just
big.
He does hit big, but he's just a more conservative tactically than Shapovalov, and in this case, just margined him out.
Yeah, and you know those breakers are what, 2, 4, and 3, I think. I mean, he never really had a chance to win those sets in the breakers, and Carney Busta just doesn't give you anything.
Exactly.
Like, you have to be able to go out there, and you have to be able to actually beat him straight up. Just again and again and again. And I mean, this is why the guy is basically marching towards the top 10. I mean,
right.
I think people haven't been following him all that closely, generally speaking. But he's been playing good tennis for a while now.
He reminds me a little bit in a way of kind of a bigger Ferrer, in a sense of he just doesn't give you anything. And you have to go out there, and he's just a very steady, reliable guy. Like, you have to go out and do the work, and you have to come up with the goods. And if you don't, then you're going to... I mean, he hasn't dropped a set this entire tournament yet. Now, granted, his draw hasn't exactly been... I mean,
he hasn't been crazy, but that's still pretty good.
Yeah, Shapovalov. But, I mean, regardless, you know, he's through this far, and he hasn't dropped a set. So that, to me, says a lot.
The thing that stands out to me is the guys that have played him that I've talked to afterwards. Like, we refer to him... Carreño Busta, that is, as being like steady and not giving you much and being solid and being maybe a bigger David Ferrer. But when guys come off the court against him, they all say the same thing, which is, I didn't realize he hit the ball that big.
Sure.
Like, they're just not able to get onto anything. They feel like they're defending all the time. And at the same time, it feels like he's not doing anything. Like, he's not taking any risks. And so that's a tough thing to combat.
Yeah. And that's where, to me, you know, if Shapovalov margined better and, you know, got on a cross court and stayed there a little bit longer and went down the line or inside out or inside in on a better ball, you know, he'd walk away from that with a straight set win instead of a straight set loss. But, you know, he didn't. So if we look at Schwartzman, Carreño Busta real quick, since we just talked about those matchups, who do you see getting through out of that?
I mean, I got to think Carreño Busta. Just because I think it's so much easier for him to generate power.
Yeah.
Schwartzman's playing so well. I mean, this guy, I think for the last 12 months, has had some of the best groundies on the tour. He's had some of the best returns on the tour. I remember when guys played him in Melbourne, and they were just, like, so frustrated.
Right.
That, I mean, that he was just so tough to play. I mean, he's actually hitting winners on people from a meter or two behind the baseline. And if you don't know Schwartzman, I'm going to say he's 5'5". They say he's 5'7".
Yeah.
And I don't believe that for a moment. Okay. Like, I would bet my favorite tennis racket that's not accurate. If he's 5'7", then I'm 6'1".
And I know you're not 6'1". Because if you're 6'1", then I'm okay. We won't start that.
We don't need to play that game. But look, the dude is not large. Okay, I mean, he's 150 pounds, soaking wet, like with a backpack on. He's very strong. He's very stable. He moves brilliantly. He can hit the ball really well. He returns way, 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 way better than you would think that he would. But at the end of the day, I mean, the guy's maybe a half an inch or an inch taller than Olivier Rukas was.
Right.
He might be the exact same size. I mean, he's really, really small. I mean, he is like 6 inches smaller than everybody that he plays. He's significantly smaller even than the quote-unquote small guys he plays, like the Cole Schreibers.
Right.
So
yeah, and in this matchup particularly, I mean, Karina Buster's not going to give him free stuff and can basically just bring a little more power and just be... I mean, just brings more weight to the court.
Yeah, I just don't see how Schwartzman's going to be able to hurt Karina Buster, because I think that Schwartzman beats people by kind of moving him around and opening things up and then going behind him or going down the line. And it's a problem to me when you play Karina Buster if you're relying on hitting winners from behind the baseline. Yeah. That gives him too much time. I don't know that Schwartzman in particular can do that. I mean, he's not... Like I say, he's got some of the best ground strokes out there because he does, but he's not Rafa hitting forehands 110 miles an hour. Like, that's not happening.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, to me, this is very much is reminiscent of maybe two boxers, and Karina Buster is just a boxer in a heavier weight class, and that's going to be telling in the end of the day. So if we jump back up a little bit. I don't, unless you really have a compelling reason to talk about Kevin Anderson's win over Lorenzi, I think I'd much rather talk about Sam Querrey's. I mean, this was an old-fashioned street mugging. His beatdown on Misha Zverev.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things at least that I got to talk about there. One, that I didn't predict that for a moment. I think that Zverev has the kind of game that should give Sam a ton of trouble.
Yeah, I agree.
And I watched Sam play his previous match, and I really felt like you can get all over second serve. I really felt like you could get to him. It was shocking to me for him to win this so well. And the second part of that is that it's not just Mexico anymore, where Sam's had a couple of good tournaments historically.
I mean,
Sam's been playing really good tennis for the last 6 months. He's returning shockingly well. Like, his backhand is way better than we've ever seen it.
Yeah, I mean, just to throw a couple stats out there really quickly. In this match, Sam Querrey, and like, bear in mind, people, this was 6-2, 6-2, 6-1. There wasn't a lot of games played. There wasn't even a lot of points played. Querrey smacked down 18 aces, hit 55 winners, and had 8 unforced errors.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, think about that. That's crazy. There was 142 points played in the entire match, and Sam Querrey hit 55 winners. That's more than one in every 3 points ended with a Sam Querrey winner.
That's
one in every 3.
Outrageous.
Yeah, I don't even know that outrageous covers it. I really would have predicted that to be a much, much, much tougher match. I think that it helps that Querrey, you know, posts up and hits more off the ground. I wasn't so shocked with Zverev's win in the previous round, because a lot of times, like, those big serving guys have a little more trouble with the serve and volleys because they have the quick hands. And, you know, they're very comfortable at just basically almost volleying back. So, like, Isner comes up against Zverev and gets straight-setted, you know, Misha basically can just volley back a lot of Isner's serves and put a lot of balls back in play and chip some balls down his feet and just make him work a lot harder than he really wants to. And I think that really showed in that match. And, you know, I felt like he would do a similar kind of job against Querrey. But Querrey, I mean, his quality of return of serve just was beyond anything I expected from him. And then he just did such a great job in his own serve. I mean, this was an incredibly dominant performance. Now, so Querrey comes up against Anderson next. Anderson's been very quietly working his way through the draw. I mean, quietly in part because there's people haven't really been looking at this part of the draw because there's not a lot of exciting stuff happening there.
I'm just going to jump in. I think this is a terrible matchup for Kevin.
Yeah.
Kevin does not like it if you can hit really big into his forehand corner. And the way Sam's hitting the forehand right now is almost comical. I mean, to me, Sam's not even moving, okay? To go back to the stat that you pulled earlier about distance covered.
Oh, yeah.
To put this in perspective, he covered something like 60% as much ground as Federer did in his 6-4, 6-2, 7-5 win over Cole Schreiber.
Right.
So, I mean, we're talking 3,000 feet versus 5,000 feet. That's like he's basically just standing in the middle of the court and hitting.
Yeah, I mean,
and hitting winners.
In the match against Zverev, he covered 3,000 feet to Zverev's 3,500. That's a huge disparity of a numbers that relatively
and,
small.
And Zverev's serving and volleying, so yeah. He's not running side to side. He's coming forward.
Yeah, it's so like points.
How could he even possibly run that much? But
Zverev's standing. And, I mean, he's taking control off the serve and then really dictating play with it.
I mean, he's literally serving and taking two steps and hitting a forehand all day long, every round against every opponent. Kevin's got a big serve as well, but I think Kevin likes to hit the serve big and flat.
Yeah.
Every now and then he likes to kick it up on people's backhands. The way Sam's returning serve right now off the backhand side, it's not going to be effective. From the middle of the court, Sam's going to out-hit Kevin in a big way. I do expect them to run more than 3,000 feet. They're going to have to cover more than that, either one of them to play each other. But I wouldn't be surprised if Sam gets through this one pretty convincingly.
Yeah, I'm in agreement on that one. I mean, I think that Sam should be the guy that walks away from this match into the semifinals. Which we're just talking about Sam Querrey making the semifinals of the U.S. Open after his Wimbledon results.
Which we thought that might never, yeah.
Yeah, crazy. But yeah, I think that's basically it's true. So it's a bad matchup for Kevin. Look, and I said this last podcast. I mean, to say that something is definitely going to happen when it comes to tennis matches is not really, I think, a good way to go about doing things. It's possible Anderson comes out and plays lights out. A million things can happen, but the odds are that Querrey's walking away from this. I would say in probably three sets, Anderson may sneak a set in a tiebreaker, but my odds would be that Querrey comes away from this in three.
I'm going to actually say that if Anderson does sneak a set out there, it's going to be because Sam plays a poor service game. It's probably not going to be in a breaker.
Right.
I think if he's solid enough to get to the breakers, then I think he's coming through in straights. And normally talking about guys getting to their first slam semifinal, nerves would really play a factor. If you know Sam, I mean, he is a stereotypical, like, laid-back California kid to a T. And it seems like just nerves really just aren't that big of a deal to him. He's going to play the same way one way or another. So if Kevin Anderson is going to get to him, he's going to have to do it through very big hitting and aggression, and he's going to have to win the mental battle, which I think is going to be tough. I mean, if KA can step up and do that, then he's really going to impress me.
Yeah, I don't see that happening either. So if we move up to the top half of the draw now, and oh my goodness, the action today, some crazy, and you know, since we're moving bottom to top, we get to jump right into one of the greatest comebacks potentially that we've ever seen in
well, it's one of the biggest turnarounds for sure.
Yeah, that we can say with absolute confidence.
So I mean, from just awful tennis to
For those who didn't, so we're talking about the Juan Martín Del Potro versus Dominic Thiem match, where Del Potro comes out and just looks half dead for two sets. And I love what you said to me earlier. Was it Gilbert that tweeted?
Brad Gilbert was tweeting, oh my goodness, like, this is so bad that chair umpire might need to give a standing eight count, like a boxing match. Like, the ref was just going to call it off and say, man, like, you have no chance. You're done. Let's just go home.
Right, like, before you get hurt.
Exactly. Yeah. We have to stop any permanent damage here.
Yeah.
And then, out of nowhere, wins the third set pretty easily, and just all of a sudden we see old Delpo. Thiem gets a little bit tight, and Delpo just starts wrecking the ball, hits all of his winners after the first two sets.
Yeah,
plays a solid three sets.
So let's talk about set number one just quickly. To put this in perspective of just how bad of a set for Delpo this was. Okay, he hit zero aces, zero double faults, zero winners, and 15 unforced errors. Del Potro hit zero winners in an entire set of tennis.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty bad. I mean, he wasn't even winning 50% of points on his first serve, and he was actually serving pretty well. He hit 11 out of 17 first serves, I mean, if you can call it that. He only won 2 points on second serve. He basically couldn't get the ball in the court. It was really bad, and Thiem was just dictating everything.
Right, so we go to set two, and it's, this is interesting because you just slowly see this match turn around a little bit. So in set number two, Del Potro starts to look a little more alive, even though it's still a blowout set. He actually hit a double fault, which, funnily enough,
we like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it just shows a little, hopefully, it was a little bit of a, he's actually pressing, you know, like coming up with something a little bit now. But, you know, he comes up with five winners. Still 0-for-3 on break points. But this is the thing I think that was interesting to me to start with, is that he got 3 break points in that first set despite playing so poorly. And this maybe should be our first red flag for team, in that, look, if you're winning a set 6-1 and your opponent's really playing that poorly, you know, you shouldn't be facing break points.
Right. How did that happen?
How did that happen? And this comes back to, you know, something that I mentioned, I think, briefly last podcast, where Thiem isn't, I don't think, doesn't do a great job at the moment managing his backhand side as well as I would like to see him do. And, yeah, I don't know, that's just thought number one. And so to me, like, he's just making errors that he doesn't need to be making. You know, there's some...
Well, to me, Thiem is still a guy who really, tennis is all about hitting the ball for him and less about tactics and moving the ball around in order to construct a point. I'm not saying that he can't construct a point, because he certainly does. But it seems pretty clear that he spends probably 90% of his energy on hitting the cover off the ball, which he does exceedingly well.
Yes, shoots the ball beautifully.
But certainly, if you started to add more elements of point construction, discipline, strategy, tactics into Thiem's game, we start to think of him as a player that, I mean, we think of him in a completely different light. I mean, he starts to get scary because, I mean, he hits a big ball all around. Like, he can do everything.
Right, he has a lot of tools.
A lot of tools in the toolbox there. So I'm just sort of waiting for that to change. I'm waiting to see if that ever is going to change or if it's a mentality thing. Early on, I was happy to chalk it up to youth. But I feel like Thiem's been around for long enough now that it should, we should start to see different things. And a match like this against Delpo is either a sign that, hey, this guy's not going to be a tactical player over his career, or this may be a turning point where he looks at this and says, okay, I mean, the guy couldn't get a ball in the court. He has 15 unforced errors, and he still has 3 break points against me in a set where I dominate him.
Right.
And then in the next set, the guy can't even serve 50%, but the guy won almost all of his second serve points because he's just going to straight up beat me from the ground, and he gets a bunch of break points. You know, so we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it'd be interesting. Just... Yeah, so I think you're talking about the third set.
I jumped ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, the second set, same story, basically. I mean, like, he looks a little more alive, but still making a ton of errors. 0-3 on the break points. And Thiem runs away with it. And then the third set, you know, this to me is where Thiem should have closed the match out. You know, he absolutely should have closed the match out in the third set. Because this is where, like, look, you've got a guy on the ropes. He's out there. He's not feeling well. He's getting absolutely wrecked on one of the biggest stages in sports. This is where, to me, Thiem should have closed this match out. But instead, here's what we get from Thiem from a statistical perspective. 44% first serves in play.
Ugh.
I mean, right there, you're giving him a look at a chance to get into the match.
Well, look at his win percentage on
first serve. Well, the next thing I was going to say. Wins 29% of his first serves. Which, I mean, by the way, in this entire set, he only puts 7 first serves in play in the entire set. And then, you know, similarly bad numbers on the second serve. He's 4 for 9. So he
only wins 6 points on serve in the whole set after he just won a set 6-1, 6-2.
And then 8 points receiving. So Thiem wins 14 points to Del Potro's 28 in the third set, being up 2 sets to love against a guy who's sick.
Abysmal.
Yeah, that's a really, I mean, you know, if you talk about, like, giving somebody a second chance, I mean, you can't really ask for a more clear example of that happening than this third set from Thiem. You know, I don't want to take anything away from, I'm not trying to take anything away from Delpo here. Like, obviously, kudos to Delpo. I mean, he's out there and he's trying to find a way, you know.
Well, he found it.
Yeah, he found it, but he had a little help, you know, from the guy on the other side of the net. The guy that's supposed to be making his life harder made his life a lot easier.
Something's got to be going on there, because even if you go back to the second set, I mean, Delpo only won 7 receiving points. How do you have 3 break points if you only win 7 points in the set?
Right. And, like, you won a lot of them in one game. That's for sure. I mean,
the guy's got to be helping you. He's got to be playing an absolutely awful game in some sense.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Just not getting the tactical picture, or he's not having a feel for the timing and the sense of what's going on. I mean, there's lots of different ways we can talk about it, but you're definitely keeping him around.
Right. And then obviously the fourth set, this is where the match was really up for grabs. It came down to the breaker. But then you look at the breaker and it's not even... I mean, Del Potro, it's not even... And Del Potro's come alive at this point. You know, I mean, he hits 10 meters. Yeah. He hits four aces. I mean, now he's feeling it, you know?
Yeah, and he played well in the breaker. Yeah. He returned well.
He wants to be out here now. He wants to... He thinks, I've got a shot. Like, I've got a real shot to win this match. And yeah, he's fighting for it.
And there's something about staging the epic comeback that gets Del Potro, like, hyper-motivated.
I mean, this guy spent half his career coming back from injury. So coming back from a 2-6-love deficit probably seems a little bit easier than all that rehab.
Well, it gets him pumped, you know? And sure. At that point, like, when you let him have that 6-1 set and then let him hang around to 2-all, to 3-all, to 4-all to get to the breaker, like, that was just a massive mistake. Yeah. You do not want to have to play Del Potro at the U.S. Open in a fifth set.
Right, because remember, this is the one slam that Del Potro's won. Like, if he's going to feel good anywhere on a tennis court, this is going to be that place. I mean, he's got some memories here.
And the crowd's behind him. Yeah. Everybody loves him.
He's a very lovable guy. So, you know, probably the biggest disappointment of this whole match for me was how it ended in the end.
How's that?
With the double fault.
Yeah.
I mean... TM misses a forehand and then hits a double fault to drop the match.
And what makes that so disappointing for you?
Well, it just comes down to this idea of, look, like, make the guy play. Like, make him earn it, you know? Like, it's one thing if you feel like, if Del Potro's out there just smacking return winners on you for 3 hours, you know, and you feel like, God, I have to go for a little extra here, then, you know, so be it. But I don't know. I mean, just the combination of those last couple points. I mean, it's just it's the whole match in a nutshell, where TM just let it slip through his fingers. I mean, he just played sloppy tennis at the wrong time. And, you know, next thing you know, I mean, it's like in the space of 30 seconds, you know, you're in the middle of this huge dogfight fifth set, and then all of a sudden you're packing your bags and you're going home. And it's just kind of anticlimactic.
Well, it is anticlimactic, but I mean, to me, TM basically loses that match in the tiebreaker in the fourth.
I think he lost it. To me, he lost it in the third set. But, yeah. I mean, it was definitely, obviously, he had chances in the fourth. I mean, he had match points in the fourth set. Chance to walk away with the whole thing. So
yeah. I mean, I just didn't write him off until then. But once he lost the fourth, I wrote him off. I started messaging people, you know, he's done.
Yeah, you gotta feel pretty bad about his chances at that point. So next up, we've got Federer takes down Kostya. Look, I mean, we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about this. Fed's just starting to look cleaner and cleaner as the tournament goes on. People are a little worried about the early rounds and the five-setters. But the reality is, I mean, his match against Feliciano Lopez wasn't a hugely physically taxing match. This also not a hugely physically taxing match. I mean, they were out on court for under 2 hours. You know, I mean, Fed covers a bit of ground, but there's nothing... The big thing to me that I was keeping an eye on that was worrying me was Fed's first serve percentage. I mean, this guy who has career first serve percentage usually around 62-63%. And mm-hmm. in his first two matches, he was down in the mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though he played very cleanly against Filo overall, and I liked the way he put that match together, I was still a little worried that his serve hadn't come up. And look, I don't think that Fed can come out and serve in the 50s, mid-50s, and beat Nadal in this tournament. Mm-hmm. I think he has to come out and serve well. And right. This was just, the only thing I really want to touch on here is 65% first serves in play and 11 aces in 3 sets. You know, great numbers, and then 73% win on second serves. So Fed really brought the serving up a ton this match. That's really what he needed to do after, you know, I think seeing how well he was hitting the ball off the ground against Filo. Some great play in that match. And this to me was great because he came out and gave the serving performance in year two, shows that he's starting to find the rhythm, and you know, I think this is going to be, this match with Del Potro is going to be a very, very interesting one. But let's talk about it. I shouldn't actually say that. I'm not sure it's going to be that interesting, but
Before we get into that, I just want to say, if you look back at the metrics that we have on Federer, as far as his time on court and the distance that he's covered, it's really not that bad. The longest match he played was 3 hours, which isn't that long for a 5-set match.
No.
His first round match was 5 sets against TFO, but it was 2.5 hours. I mean, it was bang, bang, ball. And I don't think that those things are going to hurt him. It's not like he was playing, Goffin and having 20 ball rallies and was out there for 4 hours and, or he didn't draw for Dasko and have to have one of those physical kind of things.
No.
I think that you nailed it with the serving. When his service percentage drops from 65 to 51, then yeah, he's in a tough spot.
He's going to have to play
more points and blah, blah, blah. But, he's covering less ground than Rafa is when he has a routine win. So
right.
That's no big deal to me. I don't know what to expect between Federer and Delpo. This one is a toss-up to me. It's a hugely unpredictable because the circumstances that I think really matter here are fairly unique in the history of tennis in terms of Roger playing at this age and Del Potro, being this kind of strange player that had the biggest game probably that we've ever seen, won a US Open and then was out with injuries for so long and then is slowly battling his way back up here. But like, he doesn't have a coach. His fitness is questionable to me. He went out and was just awful for an hour.
Right, and let's be clear about something. Like, if he comes out and starts a match like against Fed, like,
he's going to lose.
Fed's not going to give you that third set the team did.
No.
Like, that's not happening. You're off the court. Like, you're just...
No, that's the thing. It would be 6-1, 6-2, 7-6 to Federer's way, and we'd say, oh, Delpo made it combative at the end.
Yeah, and maybe not even a 7-6 there. I mean, Fed might put that into a 6-1, 6-2, 6-2. It's not like Delpo really came out and played lights out tennis that third set. He just played better. The thing to me is, again, I think you're right about Delpo being this is the big question to me is, Delpo is unpredictable. People are very high on Delpo. And look, I obviously, he hits the ever-living daylights out of that forehand. And it's one of, if not the biggest weapon off the ground that we've ever seen in terms of just the sheer sustained velocity of the bloody thing. But I'm not shocked. Even I hear people talk about, like, well, if Delpo hadn't got injured, he would have won, 5 slams by now, this, that, the other. I just don't think that's true. To me, he falls into this very classic mold of these, bigger guys with very aggressive games who, when they play really well, are almost unstoppable, but they can't string together, typically, enough matches in a row to win slams. And this is Cilic, this is Del Potro, these guys that, look, once in a blue moon, they can string together enough good matches.
Right.
But, I don't think that, to me, like, Delpo is unpredictable in that. If he comes out and plays his absolute best, then, yeah, he is almost unstoppable just because of the forehand. But the odds of him doing that are not super great. I feel like Fed's probably going to take this. He's probably going to take it fairly comfortably. I think this match is going to be a little bit of a letdown for a lot of people. It's not going to be, the huge kind of slugfest epic battle that a lot of people are expecting. And I could be wrong. It's possible that Delpo does come out and play great. And if he does, then watch out. I'm just saying, I think the odds are way better than even that this is a 3 or 4 set win for Fed and he's through to the semis.
Ironically, in the past, I would have completely agreed with that. The thing that makes me hesitate right now that I'm really interested to see how it plays out is related to the changes that Federer's made on his backhand side, hitting it more flat and hitting it more through the lines. And he's done that more with his forehand as well. I don't think, it's clear he's not spreading the court as much as he used to. I think that presents a real opportunity for Delpo, that Delpo can play his favorite patterns and kind of hit into Roger's backhand. I almost did it again there, if you caught that. And it's set up, and this one is what stands out to me, set up a mid-court forehand for Del Potro that he can actually get into Roger's head by hitting cross-court forehands so big that it breaks. Okay, I'm going to use this term really loosely because you know how much I respect Roger's technique. But I'm going to say breaks down or maybe exposes the very limited weaknesses that do exist in Roger's forehand.
Let's and just I think say it's overpowers more maybe is a better way to put it. Because it's the, I mean, this is the point where it's like, look, if a guy hits a ball that hard and flat, I mean, I think there's a limit to human capability of being able to consistently, well, you know, hit that back.
The reason that I put it that way is because I think that if Federer is mentally committed to reacting quickly and reading that ball and swinging really aggressively back, I think he can hit back at that ball. And I think that physically he actually can handle it. I think that it's more of it's a highly unusual spot for Federer to find himself where, you know, nobody does that. Nobody hits that big and bothers him there. So it's just it's more like he's almost flustered because it's something that he's never had to deal with before. And it's not something that he's had to deal with more than two or three times in his career.
Yeah, it's a very, very rare question. So look, this match is just all going to come down to the forehands. Like, the guy who gets to hit more forehands on his own terms in this match is going to win this match. And, and you know, you talked about the Federer hitting the backhand a little flatter. You know, to me, that this is actually something that works in Fed's favor in this matchup at this time. Because of that element, you know, Delpo doesn't hit over the backhand as often or as well as he used to, and I think that he's going to have a tougher time if he gets a ball into Federer's backhand. He's going to have a tougher time running around his own backhand and hitting forehands, and I think when he does so, he's going to be more rushed and less able to take control of the point. The thing to me at the end of the day is like Delpo has a nice serve. But for his height, it's not a great serve.
Right.
And I just, when I look at this match, I just
think he's not been serving well.
No, I just think that at the end of the day, like, even if he doesn't come out and play horrible, like he opened the match against Tim, even if he doesn't come out and play horrible, I still think he's going to just, the odds are too much in Federer's favor. Like, Federer just has too many tools with which to switch play and direct play the way that he wants to. I think that, you know, if Fed comes out and serves well the way that he did today, he's just going to be in control too often, and that's going to, it's just going to bear through, and he's going to margin him out, you know. You look over three or four sets, and realistically, I think probably three, maybe four sets, he's just going to get those one or two loose service games a set from Delpo where he makes him hit a few extra balls, gets some moves on the backhand, and yeah.
I think that Fed's going to do very well to start points off that where he's not just dictating with a serve plus one strategy. But when he's not in that position, I think if he starts points off with a good low short chip backhand and draws Delpo into a lot of slice backhands, I think Fed's going to be fine. I mean, his backhand, his flat backhand is more than good enough to boss him around the court as long as he's able to use it tactically.
I mean, I think on Delpo's serve, that's great. On his own serve, I think he needs to be.
No, on his own serve, it's plus one all day long.
Serve plus one all day long. Yeah, on Delpo's serve, if he can get that return low into Delpo's backhand, get Delpo to hit one slice, I think he's going to be in good shape. So moving up again a little bit further.
What? Before you jump into this, who are we going to start with? Are we starting with the surprise quarterfinalist, or are we
starting with surprise. Yeah. No, we're following the order. So next up is Rublev Goffin. So I'm just following the draw. So we're talking about Rublev now. That's what
we're doing. Did you pick Rublev to be Goffin?
You know, this is one of these ones that I thought was really going to be a toss up. Rublev, I mean, I really like the way he goes about his forehand, and he's doing a good job. I mean, he's making good choices, by and large. You know, he's doing to me a little bit... This is very reminiscent to me of the Shapovalov-Karina Buster match. In that you've got, you know, this guy who has some pretty decent firepower against a guy who manages well. And, you know, to me, Rublev is just doing a little bit of a better job. Look, Goffin's not 100%. I don't think Goffin's playing particularly well, and that's certainly not helping any. But Rublev is playing clean, you know. I mean, he managed this match well. I felt like it was going to be close. I'm not at all surprised by the result.
this to me really exposed how much some of the top guys rely on their opponents to really just make a lot of bad decisions and almost hit themselves out of position.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rublev, I mean, he hits the ball big off both sides.
Yes.
But in a sense, he didn't really do much. Like, he wasn't spreading the court tremendously. He's not playing brilliant tactical points against Golfin. He doesn't have the best serve in the world. I don't think he has the best anything in the world.
No.
But he's just, you know, he's a fearless 19-year-old who just was like, oh, well, I'll just hit through this guy. And it was, I don't know if Golfin's just actually much less healthy than he seems, or if there was a mental sort of, like, he just caved or what. But, I mean, it's really surprising for me for Rublev to get through this match in straight sets.
Yeah, that was surprising to me. That was the thing that surprised me, is I really felt like there was probably going to be a set dropped. And that obviously didn't happen.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, like, in the locker room, Rublev's just, you know, like, oh, business as usual, you know? Like, oh, of course I'm in the quarters and I'm still in the doubles. And I'm thinking, like, one, how is this guy in the doubles at all? Like, he's not a great doubles player. He doesn't work on his doubles all the time. Like, yeah, he returns well. He hits the ball hard. He serves decently. But, you know, I mean, this is U.S. Open doubles. I thought maybe he can win a round and then he'd probably be out. But to be here in the quarters and to be, I think, in the sixth round of 16, I mean, just, man, like, right. you got to, at some point, I think, just tip your hat and say, too good. You know, I'm going to have to hit the film and figure out what it is that he did so well, because it doesn't seem like this could have been lucky.
Right. No, I mean, if this is luck, then he's a very lucky man. But, yeah, I mean, this to me is kind of the Karina Busta Shapovalov match, but with the young guy with the big weapons playing a little smarter, you know. To me, the thing is, Rublev just isn't exposing himself the same way that Shapovalov does sometimes, and you know that has a big impact. I think he's constructing the point a little better, and you know that makes all the difference.
Yeah,
it makes all the difference in the world. So.
So how's he going to do against Rafa?
Not well.
He's going to go out there and have a swing at it.
He's going to go out there and have a swing at it. No, absolutely. And look, I think he'll take a set off Rafa. I mean, look, there's a chance Rafa comes out and just steps up and just, you know, says, look, this is a big occasion, and he brings his absolute A-plus game and just wrecks this kid. You know, I think that he's going to take a set off of him unless something surprising happens.
Well, as someone who's a big fan of practice, I'm going to tell you what I saw from Rafa in practice yesterday. Normally, when Rafa practices, he doesn't miss a lot of balls. And what I mean by that is that he's just very good. And even when he's hitting aggressively and hitting big, he's still making everything.
Right.
Yesterday, when they had some rain, he was practicing indoors. And he was missing a lot. And the reason he was missing a lot is because he was just, I mean, he was full power. Mm-hmm. He could not have had more of an intention to hit the ball as hard as he could.
Oh, right.
Did I mess that up? Did I say that awfully?
I think I understood you. I hope so.
So he was absolutely going for it. Like, if you watch Rafa play matches, and then you watch him practice, you would think, like, oh, he's playing the matches at 50%. I mean, he was missing, considerably, which I liked. I mean, I'd say he's probably missing close to 20 or 30% of the balls, which is way, way higher than his normal, like, 5%. So, to me, that spells danger for Rublev. It also makes me think that Rafa's trying to push himself out of his comfort zone. And so it's really going to come down to how committed he is to staying out of that.
Right. Well, here's the interesting question, really, is he doing that for Rublev, or is he doing that for Fed?
Well, I think he's doing that for himself.
Well, sure, but I mean,
in a sense, for Fed, but yeah, I think he just wants to have more control over the outcome of his matches, and instead of playing as defensively, I think he just wants to take it more. I think
we saw him. This is one thing I was thinking about yesterday, the day before, talking with somebody. You know, he came out the year playing more aggressively, and then I feel like once we hit the clay court swing and he got back into his clay court groove, when he came back to the hard courts, he'd lost some of that aggression and some of that court position. And, you know, if you're telling me the way that he practiced is indicative, or if we see that come out in the next match, then, that's an intent that he's bringing to shift that back again, which means that he's aware of it, which is obviously a big deal.
I think that he is aware of it. I think that his default habit is really to try and use spin as a weapon.
Yeah.
And on clay, spin is a weapon, and it's not so much spin as it is height of the ball.
Well, I think the spin makes a huge difference, especially on the clay. I mean, it just makes it that much harder. Look, when we think about the ways you can actually genuinely get it rougher, there's not a lot. And one of the main means in which we've seen people do it over the years is if you step up and take the ball and really attack him and drive through it, go after him hard, push him back, you know, take some time away, and don't let him get settled. And the thing about why he's just been so incredibly tough on clay over the years is, you know, on clay, the bounce isn't quite reliable enough that you can consistently take the ball on the rise when a guy's hitting with as much spin as Rafa does. And so you have to back up that little bit, and in backing up, you give him that little bit of time. And I think once that happens, it's game over. And we're obviously on the hard court, it's not quite the same story. It's why he's been more vulnerable on the hard court surface.
Yeah, I mean, I think he just hits kind of an in-between ball on the hard court when he makes the transition from the clay. I don't expect him to go out there and play Rublev and hit the way he does in practice. I think if he did that, he'd win this tournament in a heartbeat. I mean, I don't think that people really understand. I don't think there's any way you could understand how big he's hitting in practice until you see it. I know that for me, that was the case. I mean, I just didn't really get it.
Right.
So,
well, but I, you know, the question I would have then is, that's all well and good. And I know you've seen Fed practice before, and I have too, and you know, some of the things he does in practice are just absurd. And yet we don't see quite that same thing in matches. You know, if he came out and tried to play in matches the way that he's practicing right now, or practiced yesterday, you know, knowing where his emotional comfort is, would that even be sustainable for him? You know, we talk about him
yeah.
to go out and win the tournament.
He did it in the first round of Wimbledon this year because he played John Millman, who's an Australian player that I was lucky enough to chat with after the match. And I mean, Millman's a good player. He's a guy that's, you know, like a 50 level player. I mean, he lost in the third round here to Cole Schreiber.
Yeah, but that's a different ask than saying, hey, do it against Federer in the semifinals of the US Open.
Well, yeah, I think it is. And I mean, this is kind of the thing, like, to me, like Cole Schreiber played a completely different match against Millman than he did against Federer. Like, against Millman, Cole Schreiber's a veteran. He's been around for a lot longer. He's been ranked higher than Millman, and he felt like, hey, I can do whatever I want, and I can play as aggressive as I want, and I'm going to win this match. And he did, and he played out of his pants, and he played lights out. And when Cole Schreiber does that, he's awfully good. Against Federer, he looked like a completely different person. He didn't take those chances. He didn't play the same level. And yeah, a lot of that has to do with what Roger does, but also a lot of that has to do with the intention that Cole Schreiber brings to the court. And I think that the big difference for Nadal is that he's just not going to bring that intention to the court once he's into the quarters. And I don't, right. I mean, he didn't stay
no,
with
I'm
it
with
at
you.
Wimbledon.
My point just is, so, is that, you know, given where he's comfortable emotionally, I don't think that he could come out and do that in the late stages of the tournament and that he would just blow really well. I just don't think that he's going to come out and do that and play that well.
For the record, I think that he can do it against Federer in particular. I think that he gets up for those matches, much like Nick Kyrgios gets up to play the big four. I think he can do just about anything against these two guys. Now, the flip side of that is that now you're doing it against Federer, who can hit back at you and is also capable of doing it. And that's why we have some of the best matches of all time between those two guys.
Right.
So, you know, that's what's going to be interesting to see. But he's like, he's going to have to actually play pretty well to get through Rublev, because Rublev's playing with house money right now.
Yeah, true.
He just hits big from the ground. Like you said, he's managing his risk very well. So, I mean, he's not going to go out there and just hit unforced errors and beat himself. And he's actually going to hit big enough that if Rafa's too conservative, it's going to cause problems. So it's going to be a match that's actually going to be worth watching.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, the thing is, at the end of the day, I mean, I think Rafa's going to win it. Probably in four, maybe in three. There's obviously the chance that if Rublev comes out and just plays unbelievable, the way we have seen some guys do in the past against Rafa, like, can he take it? Yeah, I mean, these kind of big-hitting, kind of aggressive guys are the ones that Rafa tends to struggle more with. They're the ones that tend to push him back and get him dropping his forehand a little bit short, and then they get on top of it, and, you know, that doesn't end as well for Rafa as most other matches do. But I still think Rafa's just, you know, bringing too much to the table. He's going to take care of this match comfortably, and then we're going to have the semi-final that everybody wishes was the final, and that's the way it's going to be. So if we look at that, then, so we're looking at, by our predictions, a Query versus Carreno Busta semi-final on the bottom half, and the Fed Nadal semi-final on the top half. And I guess once that point comes, we'll probably get back on here and talk about it some more.
Sounds good to me.
All right, folks, you have any questions, comments, or things that you would like us to talk about specifically in the next podcast episode, please do reach out. You can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
Jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
Love to hear from you all. And, you know, if you haven't already, subscribe on the website at tacticaltennis.com. Haha. And, you know, share with your friends, social media, you know. Help us get more followers.
And make sure you watch the U.S. Open.
Well, hopefully they're already doing that. If you're not watching the U.S. Open and you're here listening to this, then...
That would be weird.
That would be a little weird. Don't be weird. Watch the U.S. Open. You heard it here first. Have a good day.
Later.